Chapter 2. Brewarrina. A trail of compressed gravel ran through the railway yard and seemed little used. Dried brush and tall paspalum stems barely concealed assorted rusty railroad junk. The town had to be close. The suitcase bruised my shoulders. I transferred it from side to side with increasing frequency. I was alone, but strangely not lonely. If survival in the outback demanded measures of loneliness, I wasn't entirely ill-prepared. My life on the farm had been filled with lonely moments when I had labored on mindless tasks, digging endless fence post holes, chipping soil from uprooted ironbark trees with a crowbar, killing and cleaning cockerels, turning over chicken yards filled with a week's excretion. I knew loneliness. It was the enemy of minds more agile than mine, and there was more than one stratagem to fight it. It seemed natural as I bore my load that lines of verse would cross my mind, since such expression had often helped when I felt lonely. Verse sustained me with a playful delight, and loading inner chambers with it came easy. The works of Henry Lawson and Andrew Patterson were so satisfying, there were times I perversely sought to be alone just to visit with them. I thought of a stanza from Lawson's Outback. He tramped away from the shanty there when the days were long and hot, with never a soul to know or care if he died on the track or not. As if by command, a real racetrack came into view, then a football oval, small abrasions on the earth's red belly, but encouraging as signs of civilization. A grey clapboard schoolhouse followed, and I counted 6 rooms mounted high on concrete piers to allow air to hopefully cool anyone inside. The perfect building to greet my arrival, I thought, and scanned the windows expectantly, but no young faces showed. I plucked a drooping leaf from a playground gum tree and crushed its sweet scent to my nose. Squat, fibro-sheeted shanties soon lined the street, constructed with the sameness, like a child's building blocks. Bare necessities of permanent shelters with closed doors and shuttered windows, and old paint flaking from horizontal sideboards. Wealthier owners would have added wrap-around verandas, but there was nothing pretentious about these huts, whose sole purpose was shutting out the sun, and that sun fairly blazed on the iron roofs. A dust eddy whirled out of a narrow lane, plucked away a few scales of paint, snapped the lid off a garbage pail, and curled across the narrow strip of bitumen I was following. It raced ahead like an eager puppy, enveloping what looked like a squatting youth for a moment before scampering on, but it was no hallucination. I stopped and stared at the first person I'd seen since leaving Byrock, an Aboriginal lad, about 12 years old, squatted by the forward wheel of a battered green truck, drawing in the dust with his finger. Who was he waiting for? Where were they? His skin was shiny across the shoulders, but otherwise a dull black, and taut, though the body was thin and sinewy. Dirt caked his knees, elbows, and neck. A mop of weather-beaten hair pulled wildly from a protruding eyebrow ridge. His nose was broad and flat. The curious thing was that his posture and whole attitude reflected the seriousness he devoted to the dust markings, for he determined not to look my way, though I was sure he'd been observing me for some time. Wasn't he amused at my struggle with the suitcase, or my swearing at the mass of flies rising and resettling on my back every time I switched shoulders? Yet he gave no indication he now had company in the street. I hadn't been this close to an Aboriginal before, and had not considered my mission might naturally involve me with them. They were rarely seen on Sydney streets and never at the beaches, and there certainly weren't any in the poultry and market garden area where I came from. The classrooms I'd visited as a student teacher had occasional Greek and Italian immigrants, but never a native Australian. Teaching Aboriginals had not been mentioned at college, so I wondered whether instructing them required skills I didn't have. Yet, white or brown, the sight of this boy jolted me to the level of responsibility I seemed about to undertake, and the brutal truth was, I realized, that I couldn't say for sure I even liked kids. It was the greatest presumption that I could teach anything to anyone his age, and my concern for what I was doing in the outback deepened. I stood staring at the skinny frame with his shallow chest and knobby limbs, while the hot pavement seared through my thin soles once again. The barrier between us remained, Eventually I crossed close enough to detect the boy's strong scent, close enough to count the flies on his face, and close enough to witness the letter D he had drawn in the dust. No idle line, this. And yet I said nothing. Then the boy twisted slightly. "Stinkin' hot, boss," he said, catching me off guard with a familiar phrase. I waved weakly, a meaningless gesture, and he continued with his work. Bathurst Street was a wide thoroughfare contained by narrow paths of buckled concrete. Beyond a Presbyterian church and a small police station, two pickups were angle-parked outside a general store which bore a large sign saying C.W. Crane's. Opposite Crane's store, the sign Brewarrina Hotel was a magnet. Cramped and weary, I staggered by Pippo's Cafe, by the Commonwealth and Commercial Banks, and across another side street, until I faced the double doors of the pub and gathered myself for the next step. Three men lounged at a round table in the cool saloon, drinking what looked like gin squashes. They wore narrow-brimmed hats, a sign of wealth, if there was substance to the law that equated brim widths with bank accounts, the narrower the brim, the fatter the purse. I had anticipated the men of the West to be tough, stringy stockmen with scorched faces, elbow to elbow at the public bar, enjoying a smoke and a beer, and ready to make room for a thirsty traveller. These three, of medium build, clean-shaven, with pressed short-sleeved check shirts, fawn jodhpurs and polished brown riding boots, ignored me. I felt about as welcome as a fly in their drink. And yet, regardless of their rude indifference, a young man half crazed with chafed parts lugging a large suitcase through heavy doors was hardly an everyday occurrence. I had to resist a strong urge to hug them. "G'day," I said, smiling broadly, a courtesy which brought no response. If I had expected a welcoming committee, this wasn't it. "Beer, mate," called the bartender, his hand poised on a tap. Do chickens have lips, I thought. A frothing midi glass came slithering along the bar and stopped, as expected, right in front of me. It was a beautiful sight. I drank greedily, scads of the amber liquid dribbling over my chin. The portly bartender continued wiping glasses with a worn towel and stacking them in rows behind him. If I was also a rarity to him, he didn't show it. "Need a room," I said, surprised at the parched squeak of my voice. The mirror behind the glasses showed a beet-red face streaked with perspiration. My eyes were a smoky blue. The crew cut bore a crown of pink dust, and dust was smudged in the creases of my frown. "How much would it be?" my thin lips said. "Half a quid." A brass key was unhooked from the till. "Room 4, upstairs." "Half a quid," I protested, looking back at the rich graziers with an appeal for this highlight robbery, but finding no support there. Begrudgingly, I parted with a 10-shilling note. Room 4 was as stuffy as a clothes closet with barely room for a dresser and a single bed. When I forced the narrow window open, a wave of hot air rolled inside, smelling strong of urine from the outdoor toilet directly below. I could see an open-air theatre down the street, then on the edges of the town, a returned Soldiers' League club. A voice from below said, "You know I can't do that, Hogan. It's illegal." And I saw the proprietor, backing off from an Aboriginal, offering him a fistful of paper money. "Just one bottle, Mick." "Sorry, try the Royal Hotel." The black man removed his soiled cap and wiped his brow. Something was odd about the shape of his grey head, as though it had been caved in on one side like a dented paint can, and the man ran gnarled fingers carefully along the creased skull. As he swayed backwards, he caught me in the act of spying, and a crooked finger came up and suddenly pointed at my face. "One day I'm going to kill a white man," he muttered. I watched him leave, dozens of flies dotting his dirty sports coat, his bare feet noiseless on the earthen path, his long woolen pants scuffed at the ankles, his weak knees taking him to where someone of lesser conscience would sell him liquor. He stopped by the corrugated iron fence, turned, and this time his finger found me in a direct line and he steadied it there, ominously, as though marking me for some future sinister engagement. Then he walked unsteadily toward the store. The proprietor, seeing the gesture, looked up and shook his head. "Don't be alarmed. Hogan always says that. Can't handle booze. Not supposed to have it. But if you can't get the real thing, you'll go across to Crane's store and get methylated spirits or vinegar or hair oil. You'll drink anything. Doesn't have much else to do." I closed the window and lay face down on the metal cot. If the Aboriginal had little to do, and he's supposedly quite at home here, I could go crazy. Normally, I was a methodical person who liked having everything in place before proceeding. This included emotions, that being the Australian code, of course, not to express emotion, not to intrude them on anybody else. To manage this, I had learned to withdraw from an inordinate attachment to the world. My mother once told me that at Christmas time I always said the right things about my few presents, but she was never really sure which one had made me happy. I couldn't remember being unhappy, but I doubted I'd be clever enough to hide real excitement. There was a good chance I never felt it. Conversely, I didn't suffer through perceived bad times, not anymore. I didn't smile often because I was never optimistic that all would be well. I didn't dream of what might be or wish things were otherwise for fear they wouldn't be, and disappointment would be my undoing. Sometimes the path of life bore flagstones of hardship and rigorous discipline was called upon when passing along it. I hadn't been led to believe otherwise. The country placed great value on endurance and courage and applauded Spartan effort like the Anzacs in times of war and the resolve of tennis and rugby players and long-distance runners in times like the present. Schools offered lesson after lesson on average people of little means, excelling with pride and confidence when called upon, and the young were expected to uphold with tradition. Whatever was in store for me would have to be met without complaint, and I lay on the bed fully aware of my cultural obligation. But I didn't like uncertainty. Since the telegram arrived, I'd been unable to influence much of what was happening, and being manipulated by unexpected forces left me about as vulnerable as a black cockroach that chose that moment to crawl out from under the pillow. I flicked it away. You know, Wilmeringa was still a question mark, a speck on a map. What would it be like? If Brewarrina was any indication, a prison awaited. To default on the 3-year teaching assignment meant reimbursing the government the full cost of the scholarship, a few thousand pounds. The family had no money, and borrowing would be out of the question. Oh, like it or not, I was a servant with a heavy debt, a slave in the government employ. My father had little time for complainers and none at all for quitters. He would have found any desire to weasel out of my obligation immoral. It didn't matter to him where I went and what I found there, but the Australian maxim did matter. You had to give something a fair go. Now, fair go didn't mean I had to kill myself. I could fall short of expectations and be fired, with a certain amount of shame involved, but hardly the end of life. I'd never been able to live up to my father's expectations anyway. I felt I'd failed at every job he'd ever asked me to do. As a carpenter, son, you got to be the world's worst hammerer. As a painter, don't hold your brush so high up and don't dip it so far into the paint. As a mechanic, are you interested in finding out how the carburetor works or not? Meaning, well, what are you interested in anyway? No amount of recrimination ever resulted in my downing tools. Rather, I worked harder to redeem myself. I always wanted to please him. Maybe he knew that. One major difference in this job awaiting me was that the old taskmaster had never been here before, never done this, and never would. The fair go limits were open to my own interpretation, giving me some latitude. I was alone, therefore decisions were my own to make. The cockroach crawled back over the gritty sheet. How many chances did it want? How many chances did it deserve? I killed it. That put an end to introspection. The road ahead was open. In the shower stall along the hall, rusty water dribbling from a chest-high spout was incapable of drawing a trace of lather from a sliver of soap. I scrubbed savagely, and as the bloodied wash from the train drained away, I hollered, "My little runaway, run, 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 runaway." I chewed a greasy T-bone and chips at the Greek cafe and returned to the pub. Night had fallen. The earlier serenity in the hotel was now a hubbub of loud talk and deep-throated laughter. Men stood shoulder to shoulder, quenching almighty thirsts. What an incredible relief! Burwarrina's lads were like the rest of the country's workers, gravitating to bars in the late afternoon to drink until closing time. There were the stockmen in their diggers' hats and black singlets, as expected, but there, too, were blue-collar workers equally capable of scoffing many pints of their favourite brew. I bought a midi and retreated to the end of the bar. "Whose shout is it?" rose impatiently from parched throats. "Yours, you mug, and hurry up. The missus wants to go over to the club later. Or she'll break you, Clive. You can't beat those bloody poker machines. What would you know, you bloody cheapskate? If Premier Caldwell's fair dinkum about doubling the child endowment, Frieda will have lots of dough. Cheers." "Whose shout is it?" "The priest's. Brother Richard's?" "No, the Catholic one, the one who plays rugby." "Speaking of rugby, I heard Darcy Henry might be buying this pub." "Oh, why would he want to come out here, mate?" "Probably taking too many knocks to the head playing for Australia. Where's the goddamn priest?" "Whose shout is it?" "Not mine. I brought the last round. It must be Stewart's." "What do you think about the Abbo stockman wanting parity pay?" "Ridiculous, I tell you what. The day the Abbo gets equal money is the last day the bludger works. I know I'll shift to white labour. Can you spare a smoke, mate?" "Help yourself, Cobber. Where did you say Stewart went?" "Don't know, mate. He must have ducked out for a leak." The good-natured banter boosted my spirits. Men, all talking loudly and at the same time, spoke of sex, sports, and rain, all scarce in the West. Naturally, they had to be talked about. Men were exhorted to remember and embellish experiences, for the memory was far too important to be lost. No women were present, but I was the object of much careful, cunning scrutiny, though still left stranded like a wallflower at a dance waiting to be claimed. Late in the evening, I noticed a flashy fellow had been doing more than his share of watching me begin to make an advance. He was one of those men among men, prominent in a circle of narrow-brimmed, hatted property owners, talking constantly, smiling readily, and slapping the backs of the well-dressed men who obviously respected him. He was good-looking, a bit overweight, in his early 30s, clean and well-groomed, with a face not unlike a cherub. Our eyes met, though there was no evidence of recognition, much less instinctive communion. However, I mentally penciled him in on my dance card. Another question went to this man. "So what happened, Bun?" "Where was I? Oh, yes. The wind had whipped up this giant willy-willy. The air was so full of black dust you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. And then it rained. Boom! The clouds opened up and the largest raindrops you've ever seen pelted down. And guess what? It rained mud. So help me, it rained mud. Balderdash! Oh, may I be struck dead if I tell a lie. Mud, bloody great gobs of it. You remember that storm back in 56, Paddy? My uncle had 2,000 sheep up near Talawanda Station and they got stranded, remember? He couldn't reach them because of the water. They stood in the bloody water for a month, couldn't lie down. He had to start shooting them. Finally, they all died. Their bloody feet fell off. Old shit. They're fair dinkum, true as I'm standing here. Excuse me for a minute, fellas." Storyteller worked his way through the maze of raised elbows until he was beside me. "Are you the new teacher for Wilmer Engle?" he asked. I nodded. "Oh, I'm here to take you out. Name's Bunny, Bunny Horville." "How far out?" Bunny's grip was cool and moist like putty. He was much shorter than he'd appeared in the crowd and not insensitive to the fact, for as I fought the urge to stare over his receding hairline, he appeared slighted and fixed me with clear grey eyes. "You'll see. You're much younger than I expected." I shrugged and tried to look older. "Bring us two, Mick," he called. "Do you have a room here?" "More like a matchbox." "What did you expect?" "I didn't think about it. Don't worry, I could sleep anywhere after that train trip. I just hope I never have to make that again." "Yeah, it's a bugger all right. Nobody who knows any better ever comes that way." The eyes snaked around the room. Whoever Bunny was, he would never have been happy as a wallflower. "Look," he said, "I'll pick you up out front at 10 tomorrow. Got a few things to do. You get some rest. We've a long way to drive. It's going to be another scorcher of a day. Well, here's a go." We touched glasses. Bunny took a perfunctory sip, wiped his upper lip carefully, and returned to the circle of sheepmen, Aftershave lotion lingered in his wake. "New schoolteacher for Wilmer Ingle," I heard him explain. "Ellie's just a kid." "Ah, they're always kids, Bunny. Teachers, coppers, doctors. They come out here like they're serving some penance. Few stay for long." "The last schoolie at Gadurga drove in, took a look around, and drove away. He never even shut off the motor." Well, I didn't have a car, and I was in the outback to do my time. After all, I'd taken the king's shilling.